Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. Today we feature the second in our occasional series on the Protestant Reformation in recognition of this year's quincentennial of Martin Luther's challenge to the Vatican on October 31st. We started the series with Professor Marion Goldman discussing Martin Luther as spiritual virtuoso. And today we continue with her co-author and a previous guest on our podcast, Dr. Stephen Pfaff. Professor Pfaff is a professor of sociology at the University of Washington with research interest in social movements, collective action theory, European politics and history, and religion. He has written broadly on a number of topics, including the collapse of Soviet Eastern Europe, mutinies within the British Navy, Muslims in contemporary Europe, biases toward religious individuals in the United States, and the Protestant Reformation, to name just a few topics that he has put his active mind to. Steve is the author of two books, including Exit Voice Dynamics and the Collapse of East Germany, The Crisis of Leninism and the Revolution of 1989, which won the prestigious Social Science History Association President's Award and the European Academy for Sociology Prize. That's a mouthful. And also he authored The Spiritual Virtuoso, Personal Faith and Social Transformation, along with Marion Goldman. And that one is due out this fall. We will provide links to those works as well as Professor Pfaff's biography on our website. I should also note that both Steve and I are involved with the Institute for Religion, Economics, and Society, run by Larry Anacone, Jared Rubin, and Chris Bader, all previous guests on this show. We help to facilitate workshops for graduate students writing dissertations on religion. So if you are one of those folks and are listening, please visit our website for more information on how you can get involved there. We had Sarah Dreyer on a few weeks ago, and she was a graduate of that program. So going through IRIS, you can possibly get on Research on Religion. What could be more exciting than that? Steve, welcome back to Research on Religion, and it is good to have you here as my go-to guy on all things Lutheran.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and I hope that I can satisfy that lofty request.
Oh, you always do, so that'll be good. Here's what we want to accomplish today. We want to give our listeners a general lay of the European landscape in 1517, the year Martin Luther lit the fire of the Protestant Reformation by nailing a set of 95 talking points about indulgences and salvation to the door of the Wittenberg Cathedral. This was a major historical event, so I think it is important that we get some historical context on Luther's world so as to understand why this particular guy, Luther, and maybe a few of his religious cohorts, including Calvin and Zwingli, were successful in creating a schismatic movement within Christianity, whereas others, more particularly folks in the past, were not successful at doing that. So help us out with that. Let's start with what Europe looked like demographically and economically in, say, roughly the century leading up to 1517.
Europe at that time, at the end of the 15th, beginning of the 16th century, was in many ways a dynamic society. And it's one of the exciting things about situating the Reformation in that time period to think about the ways that this society was changing economically and politically, demographically. So populations were rising. There was some increasing urbanism. There was greater volume of long-distance trade. Banking and other financial innovations were making their way through Europe, making themselves felt. At the same time, we could exaggerate that. This was still an overwhelmingly agrarian society. The vast majority of the population still lived in the countryside. Maybe, you know, it depends on the region. Some parts of Europe, like northern Italy or Flanders, were more urbanized. But really something like, you know, 85, 90% of people still lived in the countryside. And most cities, especially in Central Europe, in the area that became that we know as the Holy Roman Empire, but especially in Central Europe, most city sizes were quite small. Cities of 25,000 or 40,000 were really big. So most cities were only a few thousand people and actually served as kind of commercial manufacturing hubs of surrounding agricultural areas. So in some ways, the society was expanding economically. Trade was increasing in volume. There was more long-distance exchange. But at the same time, it's still overwhelmingly an agrarian society.
Now, they call this period the late medieval era or late medieval period. What does that mean? And what does it mean to be medieval? And what's this whole thing about feudalism?
So, of course, feudalism was a political and economic arrangement in which land was divided out across barons or other feudal lords. And these lords held that land in exchange for a promise to provide military assistance during during wars or other emergencies to their lord, to their king or duke. And these barons had a number of responsibilities, including local peacekeeping. They were magistrates and so on. So one of the things was that sovereignty in this world was fairly divided. Kings generally were not very powerful. Princes had to cooperate with these various feudal lords. What made Europe at the end of the late Middle Ages interesting is that two things were starting to happen. One, these princes started to become more powerful. And in countries like France or England or Spain, there was definite consolidation of royal power, royal authority. That process took a while, and there was a lot of resistance to it, many wars and rebellions by barons. But that process was occurring. Less so in Central Europe. The Holy Roman Empire was a feudal arrangement, and it was also a kind of interesting empire in the sense that it did not have a hereditary monarch. The emperor of the Holy Roman Empire was elected by an electoral college that consisted of princes, prince bishops, and free cities. These were wealthy cities that had purchased their liberties, usually from the emperor or from local rulers, and then over time gained some say in who would be the next emperor. So these, as a result of relying on this electoral coalition to become the emperor, the emperors weren't very strong outside of their own domains. I mean, they were rulers in their own right. They had their own territories. But outside their own territories, they had really only indirect authority and really relied on these proxies to get anything done. And that meant that most of the time they had to conciliate the princes or the cities, the prince bishops, rather than really enforce their authority. Now, one thing that was unique about Central Europe was that even cities which were not technically imperial cities or free and imperial cities had charters of self-government. One of the things that made this Central European feudalism interesting was that these cities had local authority, town councils that allowed them to elect their mayor or their town councilors, and had kind of constitutions that limited power and gave different interest groups in the city, guilds, for example, some say in managing urban affairs. So this was, again, another condition which made, let's say, created opportunities for diversity in the late medieval world that gave a kind of opening for the religious movements associated with the Reformation.
What kind of things are happening economically at this time? Do we see new industries? Do we see trade expansion? How does circa 1500 look different than, say, circa 1200?
There was a greater volume of long-distance trade, although, again, we should keep in mind that, you know, by contemporary standards, that volume of that trade was minuscule. But there was greater volume of trade. And in Northern Europe, for example, the Hanseatic League, which was a trading alliance of Central and North German trading cities, was really expanding and was engaging in trade that linked Central Europe to Eastern Europe and the Baltic Sea, and then also to the North Atlantic, to Holland, England, and ultimately to the Mediterranean too. Still, there was trade, and that trade was expanding. Towns were growing in size, if, again, somewhat modestly. In terms of manufacturing, there was more craft production. And one of the great new industries of the early 16th century was mining. A number of German principalities were becoming much richer as a result of more effective mining. Yes, iron, but especially also silver and lead. So mining was one of the kind of boom industries of the early 16th century. That really helped European expansion, not only because these metals were often useful, but because it also increased the supply of money, which allowed trade to be more productive.
So people are moving around a lot. They're moving into cities, and there's this growth of these things called guilds, too. What are guilds, and how do they play a role in the economy here?
Guilds were trade associations, associations of producers, really. I shouldn't say trade associations. They were associations of producers, for example, shoemakers or cordage and rope makers, who would form a guild, and then they would essentially control the production of that good in a given city or region. And doing so, they were able to do two things. One, they limited entry. So they limited how many masters could set up a shop, how many licenses, so to speak, were granted for practicing that trade. Second thing they did was they set prices. And a third thing they did was guarantee quality, because they had examinations which were given to people before they could be moved from apprentice to journeyman or journeyman to master. So they were pretty much producers' associations. They were often, as you can imagine, hostile to what we would think of as free trade. They didn't want actually free trade, and sometimes they were opposed. The long-distance merchants, for example, Hansards, the leading merchants in the Hanseatic League, Hansards and guildsmen were often at odds, because the Hansards were interested oftentimes in bringing in extra local goods, which was sometimes resisted by guilds. Guilds mattered a lot in the politics of cities because the guildsmen were well organized. Guilds often had a religious function. They were often had a patron saint, or they also had a kind of religious benevolent function, like collecting money for funerals or assisting the widows of their members and the like. So they were powerful civil organizations as well as economic organizations. And in many cases, the early Protestant movements got their strongest support from the guildsmen, oftentimes because the guildsmen were jealous of the privileges enjoyed by patrician members of city councils or by the wealthy long-distance merchants in city councils.
We have a fascinating podcast by Gary Richardson that we recorded about 2 years ago on the religious role of guilds and how this played out in the 1300s and 1400s. We'll link back to these folks, these guilds. We oftentimes think of them as unions, but they were really unions of middle-class individuals. Do we start to see the emergence of a middle class during this period of time? I know it's not like the middle class we'd think about today in the 21st century, but were they the burghers, the bourgeoisie of the time?
Exactly. And when we speak, you know, of the bourgeoisie of the expanding towns, that, for example, in Marx or Weber's account of the origins of industrial capitalism in northern and northwestern Europe, yes, that's exactly the kind of people they have in mind when they're speaking of the bourgeoisie. These were people who had some means, often not very wealthy, but had means, had some degree of independence, and who were increasingly politically assertive, interested in asserting their interests, and also increasingly literate. One of the hallmarks of the early 16th century, late 15th century, was increasing literacy among towns, especially among townsmen. And that was a result partially because of the invention of the printing press, which lowered the price of printed materials, made them more accessible, but also because of the expansion of all kinds of schooling. So, for example, what we would think of sort of as primary schools began to become more common. Also, many towns founded Latin schools that would teach people not only how to read in the lay language, but also how to read Latin, which could prepare them for university study or just prepare them to be more effective business people, merchants, and the like. So that's one of the other hallmarks of this urban expansion, was not only the rise of this bourgeoisie in an economic sense, but also the rise of, I think, what you could speak of as a bourgeoisie in a cultural sense. People who were less deferential to existing ecclesiastical and aristocratic authorities, who had a growing sense of confidence, who were much more literate, and who were buying printed material in the lay languages, who were interested in reading in their local dialect of German, for example, or French or whatever it might be. That's one of the real hallmarks of this period. And of course, without that, it's hard to imagine that someone like Luther or Zwingli could have had much of a basis of support. It really relied on being able to appeal to these kind of middle-class townsmen who were increasingly interested not only in political affairs but in cultural and religious ones too.
Now, you mentioned schooling increasing in some of these towns, and you mentioned primary schooling. But another thing that's going on, and this is going to be important for Luther, is the university system. What is taking place within the university systems? And also tell us a little bit about this Wittenberg University, which your co-author Marion Goldman said was like the Siberia of higher education.
Yeah, that's right. So across Europe, there were a number of old universities, you know, the famous ones like Bologna or Paris or Oxford. But toward the middle and the end of the 15th, going into the beginning of the 16th century, a number of new universities were founded, especially in the German-speaking lands. And altogether, there were, in 1517, there were 17 universities in the German-speaking lands in the Holy Roman Empire. And the youngest of these universities was Wittenberg. Mimi is correct that Wittenberg was not a high-prestige university. It had been founded by Prince Frederick of Saxony as a way to bring more prestige to his realm and to produce functionaries he could use in his expanding administration. But it was not a high-prestige university. It was a new one. It didn't attract the brightest scholars, but it did bring in young scholars, people like Luther and like Philip Melanchthon, and those people were pretty decisive. I think had Wittenberg been a more established, a more prestigious university, it's hard to imagine that the young faculty revolt, and to a large extent the origins of the Reformation lie just in that, in a young faculty revolt. It's hard to imagine that a handful of young faculty in their early 30s could have kind of taken over a university and offered this new theology and offered this really profound challenge at a more established place. It would have been much easier to hold them down. It also explains why Frederick backed them as long as he did. After all, Frederick wanted this new university to succeed. It, you know, represented a pretty substantial investment on his part. So he wanted it to draw attention. He wanted it to become an important university. Now, he didn't want it to cause him too much trouble or to, you know, lead to ultimately to an invasion by the emperor or something like that. But on the other hand, he wanted to protect the liberties that he believed university faculty were entitled to. In fact, that was recognized all over Europe. So he had a kind of ambivalence. On the one hand, he didn't really want a direct challenge with the church or with the empire, but on the other hand, he had strong incentives to protect these young faculty and at least give them liberty of speech. That was the main thing when he protected Luther after 1517 into the early 1520s. The main basis on which he did so, at least rhetorically, was to say, I'm protecting his rights as a scholar to raise questions. I'm protecting his right to initiate debates. I'm not defending the content of his claims. He said, that's not up to me to decide. I'm not a theologian. But I will say he should not be deprived of the liberty to raise these questions. And universities were important, really important in that regard.
So very unique, perfect storm building here in Central Europe. And there's another entity that we haven't talked much about quite yet, but you mentioned it in passing, and that's this thing called the Catholic Church. It's kind of a big deal in the medieval period in Europe. What is happening religiously with Catholicism at this time?
I think that's a really interesting question, Tony. In fact, I think it's one of the most interesting. You know, I'm not a historian, but in reading historiography, to me, one of the things that's most interesting is the varying depictions of what the level of piety and the culture of late medieval Catholicism was like. Because on the one hand, there were tensions. There were tensions caused by things like the indulgence trade, tensions caused by excessive veneration of saints, of the commercialization of pilgrimages and the like, that struck many sensitive and religiously minded people, many of them among that newly literate bourgeoisie we were talking about, that struck them as tawdry or untoward or not true religion. So if we look for it, we definitely can find evidence of religious malaise, of people who are no longer at ease with the state of religion. And the talk of reform actually was constant, had been for a long time, for centuries before Luther. He wasn't the only person proposing reforms. And many people who remained loyal to the church also wanted reform. So everybody wanted reform. The question was reform what, reform and how far should you go, and the like. The reason it's interesting because if we look on the other hand and say, was the church vital? We can also find a lot of evidence that it was. There's many instances in which popular piety was thriving. It's not true that all of this bourgeoisie was shut out from religious experience or felt alienated from the clergy. There were a lot of new lay orders and opportunities for lay people to become more involved in organized piety at the end of the 15th, early 16th century. So in some ways, it presents a mixed picture. To me, it's a Catholic Church that has some severe vulnerabilities, some of them caused by excesses of venality, venality in the clergy, some of it caused by being too worldly, too connected to political power. For example, sale of offices, simony, the sale of offices. That was actually one of the things that helped provoke Luther's protest in the first place. There certainly was all that. On the other hand, it was a vital, rich, lively religious tradition. And one of the things we have to also, it's kind of hard for us to imagine, is the kind of cultural unity that single church provided Europe at that time. There was a common culture that connected people from the Adriatic Peninsula, from the Iberian Peninsula all the way to the Baltic. They did have a culture in common, and that offered a lot.
Yeah, we oftentimes overlook that because Europe, as you alluded to previously, was very fractured at this period of time politically and geographically. So having that common institution that linked everybody together was very important. You talked about different sources of venality, and that's just a great word to use here. And a lot of times this comes up in discussions of the Protestant Reformation of really what gets under Luther's skin. Let's review some of these in case some of our listeners are not fully aware of them. You mentioned indulgences, commercialization of pilgrims, veneration of saints and simony. Let's cover those four things and start with indulgences and this new concept of purgatory, new meaning a couple centuries old, but tell us about that first.
Well, the idea of indulgences was based on the idea that the church contained the church controlled an enormous reserve, an enormous treasury of sacred merit that had been accumulated by the saints. And the church was empowered to use that that sacred treasury to reduce the amount of time people had to spend in purgatory before their souls were purified enough to go to heaven. Now, there were different ways to win an indulgence. You could win indulgences, for example, through good deeds. You could win indulgence from taking part in a holy war. You could win indulgences from helping to construct a church or help orphans or something like that. You could also win you could also get indulgences through purchases, by purchasing a writ of indulgence in which basically you were contributing to some benevolent good through this purchase of this indulgence. And it was really this part that really bothered not just Luther, but a lot of people at the time. The idea that people could substitute a kind of false assurance of piety through purchasing things, that you could kind of, that somehow that God could be bribed or swayed through commercial transactions, that struck them as really offensive. The idea that maybe people who were not very religiously reflective might think of themselves as having somehow earned or won their merit through a purchase or through a good work, that really bothered them. And so that was objectionable. And then, for example, in the case, in Luther's 95 Theses, came in response to an indulgence drive, which was trying to raise funds, which were in part going to reimburse an archbishop because he had just spent a lot of money buying another ecclesiastical office. So that links indulgences to simony, to the buying and selling of ecclesiastical offices. And that was widely objectionable. Many people, including many loyal, pious Catholics, didn't like the practice of simony. So if you think, so what kind of really bothered Luther was that here was this nobleman who was also a high-ranking church prelate using a great sum of money to buy additional church offices and then issuing an indulgence to help offset his costs. This struck him as, too secular for one thing, like really having a secular motivation, and then, duping common folk into thinking that they were good people or pious people because they contributed to this sort of, immoral bargain. So that was one set of objections. Another set of objections had to do with, there were really two kinds of clergy. There were the cloistered clergy, the monks, and there were the so-called secular clergy, like parish priests and the like. And by the early 16th century, there was a widespread feeling, not just among those who later became Protestants, but there was a widespread feeling that the secular clergy were sort of badly trained, in it for the money, not very committed, and so on. Monks, it was a different story. There was a lot more admiration for them and strong attachment to the monasteries and the many good works they did, for example, establishing hospitals, feeding the poor, and the like. But the secular clergy were increasingly resented. Also recall that in the towns, they paid no taxes. Their properties were exempted from tax. They were not obliged to perform civic duties or other civic obligations that their neighbors were. So here you can imagine you're a member of the town council or a sober guildsman, and here you have a situation where, let's say, a third of the properties within the town walls are owned by religious orders or by church parishes, and you can't tax these things. The people who work for them don't render any services. They don't serve in the town militia. They don't make contributions. It's starting to feel very heavy. It's starting to feel very burdensome. And you can see why it would be appealing when reformers came along and said, we should abolish this special status of the clergy. We should abolish these special exemptions and that these people should become regular members, contributing members of the community. You can see why that would have been resonant with a lot of people who cared about better government and fairer taxation.
One of the interesting things that we mentioned earlier about the economic dynamism at the time was that you had an increasingly monetarized economy thanks to greater mining and the spread of currency as an economic institution. Not surprisingly, that a lot of these church practices that may have started as good deeds now become highly commodified in many ways.
That's a great point. I think you're right. I think that part of the dilemma the Catholic Church faced was that in the context of a commercially expanding society, it was hard to avoid some commercial entanglement. And many of the norms of the church had been developed before this level of commercial activity. So the problem was is that a lot of the values and teachings of the church seemed hostile to this business expansion. And yet, the church seemed very implicated in it. So that obviously was a contradiction and made it the church seem unappealing. Luther, for his part, for example, was an economic traditionalist. Like many people associate Luther with the rise of capitalism. But we have to be very cautious in doing that because actually Luther's values were not pro-capitalist. He actually didn't like long-distance trade. He didn't like luxuries. He actually would have preferred a kind of simpler kind of economy based on a set of moral rules, sort of producerist rules, rather than trade and finance, which he was very suspicious of.
And as Mimi Goldman mentioned in an earlier podcast, he was a monk. He was one of the monks who really saw the church as a place to invigorate your spirituality or your religion, so stepping outside of some of that commercial framework.
Yeah, and there was also another worry. People like Luther, and Mimi's quite right to say that some of the greatest concern, pastoral concern for the laity, came actually out of the cloistered orders, because a lot of these members of these cloistered orders, Luther was an example, his Augustinian order was one example, they actually did a lot of preaching and pastoral service to lay people. And they were sort of worried. They believed that the church was neglecting the spirituality of common people, that it was saying to them, well, you could do occasional things like go on a pilgrimage or venerate a saint or buy an occasional indulgence or something like that, and you know, basically you're fine, or you know, your spirit is in good shape. And they really objected strongly to that. They wanted an enlivened spirituality that would give everyone a chance to experience holiness in an internal and more profound way. So one of the things they didn't like, for example, about the cult of the saints was that it had their view was that the veneration of saints had shifted from studying saints as moral exemplars, as people who taught us a lesson about service to God or how to get closer to God or the image of Jesus, and instead focus on the saints as wonder workers, as people who could do, or powers, supernatural entities whose assistance would allow you to do magical things, or, you know, like cure an illness or catch more fish or something like that. That really was objectionable to them. Like Luther really, in some of his writings, really lampooned that aspect of it, said it was, you know, really ridiculous, and felt that the church had been too confiding of that kind of a kind of popular religiosity that had lost its center and had become kind of tawdry, kind of cheap, kind of showy, that didn't focus enough on internal piety.
You mentioned cult of saints here. That was one of the other things that set a lot of these reformers off. How does this actually work at the grassroots level? They're wonder workers. You go and pray to them, but does each village have their own? How does this cult of saints work?
There were two kinds of saints, really, you could say. There were local saints, saints who were mostly venerated in a given town, who were like patron saints of a given town. And then there were more general saints or celestial personages like, for example, the Virgin Mary, who could be venerated anywhere and who could be called upon for assistance or intercession. What I found in some of my work is that the local cult of saints, where there was a particular saint who was the saint of the saint strongly associated with the community and with the civic life of the town, I found that this expression of the cult of saints actually bolstered the hold of the local Catholic Church, made the Catholic Church more robust in a given area. And I think the reason why is, drawn, you know, from reading the historical materials, is that what it did is it provided a kind of bridge between elite religiosity and popular religiosity. It gave ecclesiastical elites and local aristocrats or local patricians, it gave them an opportunity to fund civic life through processions and festivals and the like. It gave people a chance to take part in often very emotional kinds of ceremonies around that saint. And then during times of emergency, like a plague or a famine and the like, that saint would be sometimes taken out of the shrine and paraded around and generated kind of a popular demonstration that probably affirmed the solidarity of the town, helped it pull through. So to my surprise, in a study I did with a relatively small number of large cities for which I had good data on different manifestations of the cult of saints, I found that actually cities that had a robust local cult of saints, as opposed to these other broader holy personages, were less likely to adopt the Reformation than those that did not.
Yeah, you've done a lot of work on this, examining a lot of these things. And I want to talk about the story that goes on here, all these different factors coming together in a perfect storm, with Luther being the spiritual virtuoso at that moment in time. It's a really unique period of history. I just want to step back 1 minute. We talked about simony, and you had mentioned that, you know, earlier, that the church had set up a lot of these different types of institutions, indulgences and simony and things like this, and they get transformed over time as society gets commercialized. Simony is a very interesting one because it just seems like, how could there be any potential benefit to selling a religious office to our 21st century ears? That just seems horrendous. But it actually, you know, in the 800s, 900s, in the thousands, it actually made a lot of sense in terms of how to fund the church and to try to build a trustworthy network of people who would actually return funds to the Vatican when it needed it.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, we have to remember that for all kinds of rulers, both ecclesiastical and secular rulers in the Middle Ages, they didn't have many sources of revenue. I mean, economic growth was mostly nothing, you know, next to nothing. There wasn't very much commercial activity. The economy wasn't very, you know, the agricultural economy had limited productivity. So, I mean, there wasn't really that, it wasn't that easy to raise revenues. And so the selling of offices of all kinds was prevalent in the secular as well as the ecclesiastical world. You know, feudal offices could also be purchased. As I mentioned before, the liberties of towns could be purchased, right? So rulers were rulers of all kinds, princes as well as the rulers of the church were in need of revenue, and selling offices was one of the only ways they could get any. The other thing, like you say, is it often produced agents who had congruent interests with the principal. So, you know, if you can, if you sell the offices to powerful, well-off people in your organization, that makes them invested in the continuing survival and vitality of your organization. The problem, of course, becomes, in addition to all these practical things, the church was always in a tough spot because it had to also appear spiritual and moral and so on. So the problem was when people purchased these offices, for example, the office of a bishop or an archbishop or an electoral bishopric, when they bought these offices and then didn't appear to be morally influential or didn't appear to be upstanding, this then hurt the reputation of the church. I mean, that was the problem. But you're right, from an organizational and revenue standpoint, we should keep in mind that there weren't a lot of other options available. That became less true over time because of other, you know, the expanding economy and other domains. And also, as the church started to lose out to secular rulers, the holding of lands and so on became less of a important feature of being a bishop or a prince bishop than it had been.
When you look at the early and middle medieval periods and think about the role of the Catholic Church holding together this centrifugal Europe that's splintering in several directions, it's pretty amazing that the church was able to actually do that. So we look at the venality of the church and with our 21st century eyes backwards and say, well, this how could anybody have idolized this organization or not? But on the other hand, it was a pretty miraculous organization.
I agree. And I think the real puzzle, you're right. And when we think about it that way, the real puzzle becomes, why did the Catholic Church fail? Because given that it had such enormous cultural prestige, given that it did a lot to enhance the piety of upper-class people as well as lower-class people, given that it did redistribute an enormous amount of European income as charity. I mean, this is something that's really, I think, underappreciated, mostly through its service orders. It basically did take a great deal of revenue. Eklund's work in Sacred Trust and his work in the Marketplace of Christianity talks about this. It did take an enormous amount of, gather up revenue as alms collection and then redistribute it as charitable giving. To the extent there was any kind of thing like a welfare state, it was really only the church. That was it. I mean, secular rulers did nothing of that kind. And then when you also realize that one of its other great strengths was that its flexibility, that it was really organized confederally, right? It's true that there was a pope, but really regionally, there was quite a bit of leeway given to churches. So to me, it's kind of astounding that it failed, especially to maintain its monopoly, especially when the challenge against it initially was so localized, you know, really just one region of Germany, so localized and that similar kinds of movements had easily been crushed in the past. to me, that is kind of surprising. So I think that's one of the puzzles. I think there's still more to be done there, actually, by people doing social scientific work on the Reformation and religious change.
But you've done a lot of this stuff already, and we want to talk about, you know, why then at that moment in time and why at that specific place in Europe did this all happen? Because, you know, Jan Hus tried it before and he was burned at the stake and Wycliffe was ignored as a, you know, somebody who's just wanted to write different Bibles or, you know, vernacular versions of the Bibles and all this stuff. But Luther makes it happen. And again, we set the table here for what the world looked like in circa 1500, and it was a very unique point in time. Putting all this stuff that we talked about in the last half hour together, how did it all come together to create the story of the Reformation?
To me, what we have to do is we have to think about the early Reformation in terms of a movement and a potential counter-movement. We have to ask, how did a person and his teachings inspire a movement, and how did that movement spread and influence others on the one hand? And the other, we have to ask, why did the potential counter-movement against Luther or against the early evangelical movement, why did it sputter? Why was it so episodic and ineffective for a few decades? I mean, ultimately, a counter-reformation did take hold after the Council of Trent, and actually the emperor the emperor and Catholic forces did invade the empire and crush the Protestant princes. But they weren't able to – by that point it was too late. It was 3 decades later, and they weren't able to roll back the movement. So taking the first issue first, the movement. This year, 1517, is going to be a year where a lot of attention is paid to the person of Luther, who is an extraordinary person, and a lot of very strong biographies already exist, and new ones are appearing this year or in anticipation of this year. So there's a lot of attention on Luther, who was an extraordinary person, an extraordinary intellect, a brilliant polemicist, a courageous person, a difficult person, at times a person of violent sentiments. So we know all these things about Luther, and that story about his personality and his various aspects of his career can be rehearsed kind of indefinitely. And the old confessional history, of course, was to portray Luther as the hero of faith, right? If you want to understand it, you've got to understand Luther, especially tapped by God to redeem the church. I think a different way of seeing this is trying to understand, how did the man inspire a movement? That's what's interested me, and that's what I tried to do in all the book I recently wrote with Mimi Goldman and in several articles with my collaborators, trying to understand, how did this person inspire a movement? And to do that, I think we have to understand two things. First, not just his ideas, but also his skill as a communicator of those ideas. Luther was a great publicist. Luther was a great polemicist. Luther published more than 2,000 sermons and pamphlets during his career. The man wrote incessantly. He demanded no payment or copyright for his work. He wanted to spread the message through the printed medium. And the interesting thing is, not initially. When the 95 Theses were printed, of course, or rather when they were posted in Latin, and they were intended for debate among academics. When the controversy began to spread, Luther's great innovation was in that in 1518 he published a sermon on indulgences and grace, the first bestseller of the Reformation. Seeing the enormous impact of that, Luther realized, I've got it. I've got the form, the short pamphlet, the 8-page pamphlet. And then, of course, these were vividly illustrated with woodcuts. Many of Luther's friends were great artists. And when you combined gripping, well-written, highly polemical, often humorous sermons and pamphlets with these kind of nice decorations, which often, you know, lampooned his enemies and heroized the cause, he discovered a very effective form. Andrew Pettigrew's recent book, does a nice job of showing how Luther, in some ways, really energized print capitalism in Europe. I mean, he was the first bestseller of the printing press age. And it's hard to imagine that the movement could have taken off without printing. The great historian Heinz Schilling once said, "No printing, no Reformation," and I think he's right. But "no printing, no Reformation" is a statement about necessary but not sufficient causation. So even if we say that printing was necessary, and it undoubtedly was, in my view, it was not sufficient to cause a movement. New ideas by themselves don't cause movements. It's not enough to be exposed to a new idea. You have to also commit yourself to that idea. And that means you have to commit yourself to other people. And that was the real reason, I think, that Lutheranism took off from a bunch of ideas or a bunch of criticisms or a bunch of polemics to a concentrated movement which first took hold in the towns, the same towns we were talking about before, and in which people committed themselves to not just embrace these ideas, but to activate these ideas, to reform their towns, to abolish the mass, to abolish the Catholic Church in their town and institute a reformed liturgy, reformed teachings, a reformed church. That to me is the most fascinating thing. How did that movement get going? How did it spread? Why wasn't the established church and its many allies, why wasn't it able to quash that incipient movement? Why didn't it stop it dead? One of the things I've tried to do in my work is to move beyond indicators of social factors that might have, or economic or structural factors that might have facilitated the rise of the Reformation or helped the Reformation in some location, but try instead to look at the social relations that made it possible. The relations that led people to commit themselves mutually to the Protestant movement, to commit themselves to reform, to changing the institutions. That's a very hard thing. Changing entrenched institutions is always difficult, and that's not enough simply to walk into a room and lay down a pamphlet or a book and say, okay, here's a better set of ideas, let's do it. You've got to put pressure on people. You've got to lobby. You've got to build a movement locally for those reforms. And astoundingly, that's what happened in the 1520s in German-speaking towns across Europe, is that those movements took shape and they began to press hard on local authorities to make substantial church reforms.
In terms of this issue about relations, you've written a couple of things that really illuminate this aspect of what was going on at the time. One is the proselytizers that Luther had or inspired, these students, graduate students at these universities that take out through all these different towns. And then also, interestingly enough, something we mentioned earlier, the networks of the Hanseatic League. So talk about these networks that were created.
Right. If we were to make a statistical analysis and we indicated in our data that a town had a university or that a town was a member of the Hanseatic League, we would probably find that it doesn't really have a significant, statistically significant effect on whether or not, on the odds of that town adopting the Reformation. Or it would be inconsistent, like sometimes we'd find it, sometimes not. This led me and a couple of collaborators, Hyo-Jung Kim in the paper about students and Bernd Vorpts and Katie Corcoran in the paper about the Hanseatic League, to start saying, well, the key is really to move away from these indicators and start to try to figure out ways to get closer to measuring the relations that are underlying these structures. So, for example, with students, we were able to get matriculation lists that allowed us to link towns to universities through their matriculated students. And we were able to show that towns that were closer to Protestant universities in terms of through social relations, through the actual people who went and returned, were more likely to become Protestant. And conversely, talking about counter-movement, those towns which were sent many more students to universities which were hostile to the Reformation were much more likely to remain Catholic. So that was, to me, that was a step forward because it allowed us to say, well, how does diffusion occur, the diffusion of a new idea? Does it occur simply through exposure to the new idea, like reading about it? Or does it really spread when you've read about it, you've been exposed to the new idea, and then you see people visibly committing themselves to it that you can be part of, that you could join, or who could influence you? Or, on the other side, who are implacably opposed to it and organizing themselves to do something. Most people in most periods of upheaval are bystanders. They're neither deeply committed to protecting the existing institutions, nor are they deeply committed to overthrowing them. So what you really need to do is you need to activate core groups of people who are really either for or against something. That's what determines the issue, and that's what university enrollments help to do. In the case of the Hanseatic League, a lot of economic historians and previous papers that I've done, we used proxy measures for whether a town belonged to the Hanseatic League. And the intuition was, well, since we know trade and economic development are associated with the coming of the Reformation, maybe those towns which were the most commercially advanced or in which merchants played the biggest role would have been more apt to adopt reform. And looking across those papers, you find inconsistent findings. Sometimes there's a significant finding, sometimes not. One of the graduate students who's working here at the University of Washington, whose name is Bernd Forbes, is doing a dissertation on the institutional emergence of the Hanseatic League, of this trade network in the late Middle Ages. And he got to talking with me and Katie Corcoran, who is a sociologist of religion at West Virginia University. She also studied here. We got to talking about the Hanseatic League and the coming of the Reformation. And Bernd said, you know, we can do better than these kind of dummy variable measures of whether a town was or wasn't in the league. He said, what we really want to get at is how involved towns were in the social networks that drove the Hanseatic League. And what Bernd was able to do was to get together data on participation in the annual Hanseatic diets, these periodic assemblies of the member cities of the league. And what we were able to do using those data was to show that it what really matters is degree of involvement in the governing in these governing conferences of the Hanseatic League. Those towns whose elites, I mean, that's who attended these events, the elite Hansards, those towns who had many elite Hansards who took part in these events, those towns were much more likely to become Protestant than the towns who had fewer. And what was nice about that was we could show why being in the Hanseatic League mattered. And we could explain variation within the league. What explained why some Hanseatic leagues towns adopted the Reformation and some not? We're able to show that those Hanseatic towns that remained Catholic, Cologne is a famous example, were ones, among other things, that played a very small role in the governing diets of the league. So we were able to show, I think, that it was what really helped spread the Reformation in those towns was not just the flow of ideas across those towns, but that people were also exercising influence across those towns. And as the Hanseatic elite in one town began to adopt Protestantism, it made it very attractive for those towns they were engaged in a lot of trade with to also adopt. And when we remember that in those days, business relationships were often sealed with the exchange of brides.
Marriages.
Right. And then we start to see why people would start to rethink. A Hansard in one town might think, if a lot of the Hansards I know, elite Hansards in other towns, are adopting the new religion, I should probably adopt it too. Otherwise, I'm going to be the out person in these leagues. In these networks, and I might actually find it harder to seal a commercial deal through marriage with one of these families. So a lot of it had to do with elite families exercising influence on each other. That helps to explain why the Hanseatic League, in our view, did aid the coming of the Reformation and why such a high proportion of Hanseatic towns ultimately did reform.
Now, during this year, the quincentennial of the Protestant Reformation, we'll hear a lot of talk about how the printing press, the Gutenberg press, was very influential in spreading things. But what I love about your work and what you're doing here is you're giving it more of a visible face of individuals, people who are actually engaged in it. And it makes it, at least for me, much more visible. I think of these students running around in their brown robes to these universities, very excited about stuff, or these members of the Hansards who are, you know, talking in a parlor about who's going to marry who on the next thing. And this is the stuff that really matters at the grassroots that a lot of times we don't necessarily see in some of the simplified proxy measures that we use for all this stuff. So we will refer a lot of people to, or we will refer our listeners to a lot of the work that you have done. So please check out our website on that. One or two other factors I just want to throw in there because you've done a lot of work on this. One of my favorite variables that you included in a study one time, and I'm just thrilled by this one because of the amount of tedious work that it took, the height of cathedrals. And how did that factor in? Why did you even think of using the height of cathedrals to measure why the Reformation spread here and not there?
We were influenced there by Robert Eklund and his collaborators proposed that the size of temple or ecclesiastical buildings could act as a kind of signaling device that would show the incontestability of a local monopoly. Larry Witham talked about it also in his book. So we thought, yeah, we need to do a test of this, and we want to test it with as large a number of cases as we can. So Katie Corcoran and I decided to try to add a measure of the size of the principal church of a town into a multivariate analysis with, you know, that has measures of many other factors that could be associated with the institution of reform in a town. Yeah, and it did take a great deal of work. Katie Corcoran did most of it to track down the height of all these buildings. One of the things we decided to do was not use the height of the church tower, because you could have a pretty small church with a very tall tower. But what we were interested in was thinking about Eklund's theory. You would think that what would really matter was, did you have a big enough structure that a very large proportion of a town's population actually plausibly could attend a religious service in that structure? So the best way to get at the square footage was to get at the height of the dome, because there's a proportion. You can only have that height of the dome to be so high given relative to the width. So you have to have a pretty wide structure if you're going to have a very high structure. So we decided to go with the height of the dome or the nave of the local church or cathedral. And the sources exist. It took a lot of hunting them down. For a few cities for which we could not get an accurate measurement, what we were able to do was to use photographs. There's a technique in which you can estimate the height of a building from a photograph of that building. And we were able to capture some of the missing data that way. So yeah, it took a little bit of innovation and a lot of work, but that was an example of trying to take somebody's concept seriously, trying to take a concept in the field seriously, and think about how would you measure it, how would you operationalize that in a larger end study.
I have to say, to all the folks who are out there listening, this is the absolute creativity, or the absolute best creativity you can see in academia to do something this tedious of a measure, to really figure things out. It's just spectacular. You can see people looking at photographs and trying to do those old techniques you learned in trigonometry to figure out how big our things are.
Exactly.
So, amazing. What did you find?
Well, actually, the thing that anyone who engages in this kind of work, economic historians and other quantitatives, social historians, notice very well, you know, most of the time you go to all this effort and then the variables turns out not to be significant in a multivariate analysis anyway. But you still, you know, you don't know that until you do it. So we found that for smaller cities, it didn't matter. But for larger cities in our sample, it did matter, that essentially the really large structures are associated with lower odds of adopting reform.
Yeah, the presence of the church there being
probably
strong.
The places where church, where local religious establishments, where the local ecclesiastical elite was extremely rich. There were a lot of cities in Flanders like that, in present-day Holland and Belgium, where they had pretty big cities, pretty rich cities, and tremendous, really big cathedrals, like the Louvain Cathedral or something, which are really tremendous structures. You know, most, the average German town in our sample has maybe, you know, 5,000 people, and, you know, there's just no plausible way, there just wasn't enough local wealth to build a really big church. So there wasn't as much variance, I think, among the small towns. It turned out there was more variance among the large towns in the size of the churches.
Absolutely fascinating work. And as I mentioned, we will point our listeners back to the places where you can pick up some of these articles, as well as the books that Professor Pfaff has written. Let's finish off with this final question here, with the quincentennial of the Reformation coming up in a few months here. What do you think we should learn from that period to understand our lives today? Is there any lesson for us in this history?
One of the great contributions of the Reformation, in my view, was the teaching that every person is entitled to try to achieve holiness, that every person is entitled to read the Bible for herself, to understand scriptures, to take part in the life of their religious community, to speak in it, to sing in it, to live a life of active holiness outside of feast days and special commemorations. That, I think, was a very profound thing in a number of ways. One, it helped to define what we mean by modern personality, what it means to be a person. It had big democratic implications, the idea of spiritual equality. And economic historians have pretty much persuaded me that the real mechanism through which, or one of the principal mechanisms through which the Reformation worked to help explain economic takeoff in Northwestern Europe, is less a shift in values and attitudes, like Weber argued in his famous Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism book, and seems more important was that it opened up opportunities for ordinary people to achieve literacy so that they could read the Bible or catechisms or sermons for themselves. And this, in the long run, meant that the stock of human capital available in countries that became Protestant was much greater. And this had a really profound long-term effect, especially when you consider that the reformers and then the princes who instituted their reforms and the secular rulers who carried on this work weren't just interested in the literacy of boys, but also the literacy of girls. So that you have increasing rates of female literacy from the 16th century on in predominantly Protestant societies, something which wasn't achieved in many parts of Catholic Europe until late in the 19th, early 20th century. And in other parts of the world today is still, you know, lagging substantially behind. So the idea of spiritual equality and everything that went along with that, particularly the ability to read, had enormous implications for the long-term social and economic development of those societies. Secular benefits as well as spiritual ones.
Great lessons, as always, from Professor Stephen Pfaff. Steve, thanks for being on Research on Religion again.
A great pleasure. Thank you for letting me talk about my work.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.